Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Brad Gooch about his new biography of the medieval Persian poet Rumi, entitled Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm a writer. I live in New York City. I've written two other biographies, one of Frank O'Hara, one of Flannery O'Connor, so both writers, as well as novels, book of stories, a book of poems, a memoir.
That background makes it understandable why you've written this biography of another writer. And yet, as you explained in your introduction, it was a very different project. You had to undertake a lot of study. What was it that drew you to Rumi as a subject? And not just as a subject, but why undertake the level of study that you did in order to write the biography?
Well, you're right about study. I mean, it was sort of a labor of love, but I maybe underestimated the labor part when I when I began. But I was drawn to Rumi, I think, as most people were, through the poetry. I was staying at a friend's house in Miami in the early 90s, and on the bookshelf was a two-volume collection of translations of Rumi that I read. And then in the mid-90s, I think it was 1995, one Christmas, I received the same present from three different people, which was the Essential Rumi translations by Coleman Barks, which was a book that created this great kind of Rumi craze almost. I mean, the phrase best-selling poet in America is attached to Rumi. It's from that volume, really. And lines such as Out Beyond Right Doing and Wrong Doing, There's a Field, I Will Meet You There, came from these Coleman Barks translations. Rumi was taken up by the New Age movement. Madonna and Deepak Chopra were recording his poetry. But for me, it was more at the end of that decade. I wrote a book called God Talk, Travels in Spiritual America. And the last chapter was on Muslims in New York City. And for that, then I joined and reported on a Sufi group, Sufism being a sort of mystical interpretation of Islam that Rumi came out of. And this group, which was mainly young Muslim Americans, was led by Imam Faisal Rauf. And again, his main person was Rumi, but less the lyric poetry and more the talks of Rumi that have been written down by his students. So his dimension then as a religious leader, a spiritual figure, became more apparent to me. And the group was made up mainly young Muslim Americans in their 20s and 30s. And they're from different backgrounds. Their parents had come from the Middle East, from Pakistan, from North Africa, Europe, Iran, Canada. And from them, I heard more about Rumi's life and more about the historical religious context. And I realized that most people didn't know anything about Rumi. A lot of people were reading the poetry of Rumi at their wedding. But when I asked around, half people I would ask thought he was Buddhist or knew nothing about him. So part of it was my desire to give a face and some kind of context to this floating name. Also, I think I was drawn by this story of, I mean, he went through a great transformation in the middle of his life by meeting with a mystic named Shams of Tabriz. And that kind of midlife transformation from celebrated enough preacher and teacher into the poet and mystic who we know Rumi to be was particularly fascinating to me.
It was interesting to read about the depth of study you went into for this. You didn't just simply look at the writings about his life. You went and you studied Persian. You went and traveled to these regions. I was especially touched by your description of how you went to a market in Syria just prior to the outbreak of the war, and how you met with someone. And in speaking with this person at the market about how he was expressing his great passion for the poet, and I thought it was interesting how, in that sense, you also, you know, are expressing in the book your connection not just with the poet, but with this very large fan base, and how that helps us to illustrate in many ways his legacy as a poet.
Right. I mean, I said in the beginning I maybe underestimated the labor involved, and part of that underestimating had to do with the language. I mean, I realized I had to study Farsi or Persian. So I went to two language immersion programs, one University of Texas, Austin, one University of Madison, Wisconsin. And they involved, you know, living in a dormitory for 10 weeks with your fellow students and speaking Farsi 24/7. Most of them 19 years old. I was a lot older. So it was an unusual experience. I also had a tutor, an Iranian-American writer named Maryam Mortaz, who then, I guess her role sort of grew through in the writing of the book to become kind of a collaborator in translation, because I translated the poems and the writings of Rumi that I used in the book. And besides that, the map of Rumi's life extended 2,500 miles. He was born in Central Asia in 1207 and wound up living most of his adult life in Konya in what's now Turkey, where he died in 1273. But the path of, you know, following this path of his life was you know, absorbing and interesting, and also and mainly the path existed because Rumi's family left Central Asia when he was young. It's not clear if they were just going on Hajj to Mecca, but while they were away, Genghis Khan and the Mongols, the terrorists of their time, descended and destroyed the land of his birth, really, and all these great cities of Samarkand and Bukhara in Central Asia. And he was basically then, they were displaced persons or migrants or fugitives, and wound up then in Konya in what's now Turkey. My journey also got me into a lot of, I mean, I suppose also in the beginning I had a kind of maybe Orientalist fantasy of going back 8 centuries into this moonlit, mystical, poetic past. And actually I kept smashing into more contemporary geopolitics than in any book that I've written. I mean, you mentioned being in Aleppo, Syria, the day that the Syrian civil war broke out. I was in Tajikistan, where we now believe Rumi to have been born, and visiting his village was sort of intercepted on my way out by these guys with assault weapons and taken off to a kind of Midnight Express style prison in Tehran. My camera was swiped from me, and this official tried to get me to follow him down into the Ministry of Justice. And so constantly I was kind of coming face to face with contemporary politics, which in a way is suiting, because Rumi lived his life in a very tumultuous and chaotic period politically and historically. And we're not even there yet in terms of the feeling of worlds falling apart that was happening around him. And that sort of made it all the more fascinating that out of it came this incredibly, you know, luminous kind of poetry and spirituality. And not just of Rumi, but of other poets who were alive at the time and other Sufi mystical thinkers.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit more as to his family background, particularly the influence of his father, who, as you describe it, loomed very large in Rumi's life.
Yeah, so he came from a traditional religious Muslim family, and his father and grandfather had been preachers and teachers. Actually, probably no one called him Rumi during his lifetime. His name was Muhammad. And then when he was 5 or 6, he told his father that he was seeing angels. And his father sort of encouraged him in this by giving him these honorific sorts of titles, Qutban Gar, Jalaluddin, which means glory of the faith. And then when he was an adult, he was basically known as Molana, or our teacher. And so the influence of his father then was great, and his father actually kept notebooks that we still have, kind of diaries, and Rumi as an adult would read these. He inherited the disciples of his father. And yet finally, when I talked about this kind of midlife transformation, is that then he wound up at a certain point going beyond his father, who is still, in a sense, a traditional religious leader, and becoming this more inflamed mystic poet.
That inheritance is a very interesting one, because you, for a good part of the first half of the book, it's as much about his father as it is about him, and how Bahá'u'lláh was basically experiencing this great arc upward, and when he dies at the age of 80, he hasn't really dipped. Rumi experiences this rise with his father, and is educated by him, and then when his father dies, Rumi, as you describe it, inherits this position at the madrasa and a lot of the students that his father had cultivated as a result of this reputation earned over many decades of being a jurist and a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you see this great admiration and love for his father. And when I mentioned that the family found themselves as migrants, when it was actually Bahá'u'lláh who was invited to come to Konya, which was then the capital of the Seljuk Empire in what's now Turkey. And the Seljuks were a Turkic Muslim tribe that started eventually in this empire. But Turkey at that point was the outposts of Islam. Most of the population were Christian. They were Greek and Armenian. When I mentioned that no one called Rumi in his lifetime, Rumi really means from Rome. And it was referring to the old Roman Empire or the Byzantine Roman Empire, and Turkey was part of that. So Rumi, by living in the what was thought of the outer lands, gets called from Rome, really. And then the name even has a shadow of meaning Christian, since most people from Rome were Christian. But they were brought, his family was brought, especially his father, to teach then, Islam and a version of Islam that would communicate with this population and also others. The main, in Central Asia where Rumi was from, it was mainly Persian, part of the old, great old Persian Empire at that time. And so, during the destruction by Genghis Khan and the Mongols, scholars now say there was almost genocide of the Persian population. So the Seljuks then sort of imported these teachers, preachers, poets, artists of this kind of high culture in their mind. And Rumi's father was very much a part of that. So actually he wound up in the later part of his life more influential, famous, revered, than much more so than he had been earlier. And Rumi then was very much set up to follow in his footsteps, and did. So he had posts at 4 different teaching colleges. He was known as a charismatic preacher, and then it sort of taken on the disciples of his father, most of whom were people who, like him, had come from Khorasan, the land of his childhood, into Konya and Turkey.
You describe how throughout these travels, Rumi is getting an education, and he's also adherent to the Sufi faith. And I was wondering if you could explain perhaps both a bit of Rumi's education and also that relationship with Sufism, because it, as you explain, it, a lot of his early career is ends up being challenged later on when he has this friendship with Shams, and how it ultimately leads him to embark upon a very different course for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Sufism is basically covers all sorts of mystical interpretations of Islam. And so it's not, I mentioned before about Sunni and Shia, these two main differences within Islam, but they're really a disagreement about who should carry on from the Prophet Muhammad, whether the power gets passed on through family like a monarchy, or as the Sunnis feel, then through the choice according to how you follow the path of the Prophet. But for all, in all these different manifestations, Sufism can exist. And so the emphasis of Sufis tended to be on a more intimate relationship with God. They stressed the parts of the Quran, such as I am as close to you as your jugular vein, that sort of emphasize closeness and intimacy. And they also used music, poetry, and song in religious practice. So that, you know, that's basic. And they also were controversial and could get in trouble. So there were famous Sufis in Baghdad centuries before Rumi who had said things like, I am the truth, or glory be to me, which sounds as if they were saying that they were God, and got them executed or in trouble. The explanation for that within Sufism is that they were emphasizing complete loss of self in God. But that, Rumi, when you mentioned his education, it went very much with his travel. So along with the misfortune, in a sense, of being displaced from the land of his childhood, he had a kind of tour of the medieval Islamic world at a time when, you know, a great amount of philosophy, art, architecture, learning was going on. It was a high period, culturally speaking and religiously speaking. And he was in Baghdad, in Mecca, then in Damascus, in Aleppo, in college, basically madrasa. These would also be in Arabic. So he was bilingual in Persian and Arabic, and had an incredible education in that sense. And it makes the transformation all that more remarkable, because he was basically a great intellectual and scholar, and then sort of threw away learning or shifted from this path of knowledge to a path of love and the heart, and away from writing sermons and fatwas to writing poetry and using, you know, music and song in his religious practice. But all of these practices were always under debate. And so there's, you know, he was always pushing, you know, at the boundaries and limits of what a religious or spiritual life could be like, and what you could say in poetry, or how you would write mystical poetry.
What was it that brought about that shift?
That's an easy question to answer. Actually, it's one person, Shams of Tabriz. So when Rumi's in his late 30s now, in Konya appears this singular figure, Shams of Tabriz, who's about 60 and was an itinerant mystic who had gone around the Middle East studying with the main religious teachers of his time, including probably Ibn Arabi, and comes to town, and he and Rumi have this electric sort of connection and meeting. It's like if you go to Konya, it's a place where they supposedly met, is still marked by the shrine. Looks a bit like a bus stop, but so it's lived on almost, the importance of this connection between the two of them. And Rumi, even though Rumi then at this point is married, has children, has a community of disciples, has teaching posts, he goes off with Shams of Tabriz and they seclude themselves for 3 months, and then they reemerge and then seclude themselves for 6 months again. And in this period, I mean, Shams of Tabriz is really encouraging him in shifting from this kind of intellectual, academic, clerical, respectable life to the path of the heart. And he actually teaches him then this whirling dance, which we associate with Rumi. And really after his death, around him, in almost the same way that the Franciscans rose up around St. Francis of Assisi, this Mevlevi order rises up around Rumi, put in place by his son and grandson. And the center of it is the whirling dervish as a spiritual practice. So Shams of Tabriz is encouraging him in all these ways of giving up reading and scholarship. Even they're both these extraordinarily learned guys. The encouragement is towards not depending on books and learning and speaking and acting more from the heart. So this is all among the effects of Shams of Tabriz. Shams of Tabriz is also trying to encourage Rumi to give up his great respectability. And so to do this, he has him go to the Armenian neighborhood and buy wine and bring it back through the streets, and wine is forbidden in Islam. So there's always this playing around with unorthodoxy as a way to give up respectability almost and move more towards this Sufi life, which emphasized poverty and meditation and prayer. And all of this causes, though, a lot of upset because, I mean, Rumi's not 18 years old. So it would be one thing to choose the life of a poet and mystic at that point. It's another when, he's in the middle of his life and has these responsibilities to family and community. And so those years of Rumi's life are very much about trying to find his way through this major life change, while also in some way still respecting his father and the traditions that he had inherited.
That family tension really stands out, and it's on both those levels. You describe how early on is when Shams encourages Rumi to not just give up hit the sort of academic approach, the intellectual approach towards, in his career, but he's also encouraging Rumi to stop reading the diaries and notes of his father. You don't really get too much into psychobiography and argue that there's some sort of father displacement here, but it does get to the degree to which there is this tension that then is also exists not just between in terms of Rumi's relationship with his now deceased father, but also Rumi's sons who have this very uncomfortable relationship with Shams and really seem to disapprove of his role in Rumi's life.
Yeah, there is this great tension that exists. It's part of what's great about doing biography in a way is we have these poems of Rumi and there's a lot of joy and peace and light in them. But it's kind of fascinating that he lived in times that were so demanding and then had a life that had a certain amount of conflict in it, and increasingly so as he got older. But yes, I mean, psychobiography, you're right. I didn't really do it, but there's a clear way, I mean, in which Shams of Tabriz is like a therapist and you know, basically sees Rumi as encourages him in a way to find his voice. It's, you know, really to find his own voice. And in this, you know, in a sense is saying, but you're not just a preacher and a jurist. You're a poet, and these, you know, poems are eventually triggered in Rumi, come out of this relationship with Shams of Tabriz. So in a sense, he's finding his authentic self. The relationship, though, I mean, you mentioned about with his sons, also his community and all of Konya, in a sense, get involved in this. And part of it is, I think, that if you were at Central Casting and wanted to cast a spiritual teacher, I don't think you would come up with Shams of Tabriz. I mean, he's a very irascible, kind of misanthropic guy. He doesn't suffer fools gladly. He's very interested in Rumi and not in anybody else. So this only adds to the tension of Rumi kind of disappearing from family, school, and community. People, you know, blaming this on Shams of Tabriz. Also, their relationship was difficult for people. I mean, the Shams of Tabriz would walk down the street and people would mutter under their breath, or even supposedly flash daggers at him sometimes. And then you have to think, well, what created this amount of anger, at least mixed feelings about Shams of Tabriz? One of Rumi's sons dutifully follows his father and likewise is a kind of disciple of Shams of Tabriz, and the other son, very much the opposite, is horrified by what's happening to the family brand, I think, and blames Shams of Tabriz for this. I think part of it is that there was, you know, it was a traditional culture. The idea of a Sufi master having a young boy who was following his example and that he was teaching him, and there was this love between them. No one had a problem with that. It was sort of coming out of ancient Greek civilization with Socrates and Plato, where there was an erotic component and a component of learning between young and old. That was part of Persian culture. Something about Shams of Tabriz and Rumi was much more disturbing. And I think it was actually the sort of equality between them. So Shams of Tabriz is in many ways a traditional teacher and Rumi his student, but also Rumi was 38 years old and was an established religious leader already at this point. And so there's an equality between them. Shams of Tabriz at one point complains, I have to know, what are we? Are we student and teacher? Are we friend and companion? Rumi records people saying, we can't tell who is the lover and who is the beloved. So in a really hierarchical sort of society, we have this friendship, companionship between these two men that seems to break the mold in some way. And it seems very modern to us, has a kind of parody to it, but is complicated and unusual and sets off or only adds to the kind of tension and conflict that you brought up.
I think nothing better illustrates the nature of the dynamic and perhaps in some ways answers the question as to the sort of the nature of the relationship than when Shams leaves. And you described there are these two periods at which he leaves Rumi. And mm-hmm. it really, at that point, a lot in Rumi's reaction, and also the fact that Shams does leave twice, that you really see some of the other aspects of the relationship really coming to the fore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the poetry that we have with Rumi, especially that we associate, are about the joy of this great transformation, of this sort of aha moment between them. There was one, you know, Rubaiyat, 4-line poem. When your love inflamed my heart, all I had was burned to ashes except your love. I put logic and learning and books on the shelf and learned the art of poetry and song. So you can see that there was this remarkable sort of breakthrough in terms of true identity for Rumi and maybe for Shams of Tabriz as well. But because of the impossibility of the situation, Shams of Tabriz disappears at one point without telling Rumi where he's leaving. He eventually returns, and then he disappears again completely. We really don't finally know what happened to Shams of Tabriz. There were rumors that he had been murdered by Rumi's son, and because of this jealousy. And this is possible, not likely, but he definitely does leave without a trace. This causes an incredible meltdown from Rumi, and he looks for him everywhere in Konya, and then eventually goes to Damascus looking for Shams of Tabriz. But most importantly, during this time, comes to rely on this whirling dance that Shams of Tabriz had taught him. And it's almost a way of holding on to his sanity as well as his connection. And then begins to use poetry to again be connected to Shams of Tabriz and to also work through way in which human love and divine love mirror each other. And that becomes his great sort of theme. And so the way that he does this, I mean, there are different things, but one thing to remember now, he hasn't really written much poetry before. At about age of 40, all these poems we know of Rumi starts writing them. And by the time he dies, when he's 67, he's written about 3,000 ghazal, which are like sonnets, about 2,000 rubaiyat, which are these 4-line quatrains, and a 6-volume spiritual epic in couplets called the Masnavi. So, I mean, he's a kind of genius for one thing. But he's very much, I mean, it's his lifeline, in a sense, his poetry. One thing he does, and he does these innovations, not just because he's trying to be a clever new poet, but to use this to work through the conflict presented to him by the disappearance of Shams of Tabriz. So one thing is, in Persian poetry, there's a convention called the takalos, where the poet puts his name in the last line of the poem, and Rumi instead puts Shams of Tabriz's name, so that when the poems are first collected, they're called basically the collected poems of Shams of Tabriz. So Rumi's not just saying he's inspired by Shams, he's sort of saying Shams is writing these poems through him. Also, the name Shams means sun in Arabic, and so it's a you know, kind of pun going through the poetry. When he's writing about Shams, is he writing to Shams of Tabriz? Is he writing about the natural sun, or is he writing about the eternal sun, God? And in Persian, the pronoun u can mean he, she, it, or God. This is a game then that Rumi plays sort of to exhaustion. It's what's important and different about his poetry. F. Scott Fitzgerald says somewhere that the intelligent person can hold two ideas, opposite ideas, together in their head at the same time. In a way, you have to do that with Rumi's poetry. You have to hold together human love and divine love, and because he writes about this spiritual life and quest in the language of this romantic poetry, and it aligns with his feelings about Shams of Tabriz. So that's really the way the poetry works.
What sort of reputation does he have in the community during this time? Has he been rejected? Has he been embraced in this new role? To what degree is his poetry celebrated by his contemporaries as he's writing it?
Well, his poetry is very important in the, in his community. And it becomes then a way of teaching. Supposedly, I mean, after Shams has died, he has someone who's much younger, Hossam Uddin, who goes around and writes down all of Rumi's poetry. And supposedly one night, Hossam goes to Rumi and says, "Well, you know, all of your disciples, instead of reading their Sufi manuals, are reading these poems by Attar, like Conference of the Birds. Why don't you, O Molana, write your own poem, kind of teaching poem, called a Masnavi, a poem about spiritual life for your students?" And supposedly then at that moment, Rumi takes out from his head scarf this page on which he's written down the first 16 lines of a poem that is what Hossam Uddin was asking for, and it's and in the right rhyme and meter, and it's the opening of the Masnavi, which is one of the more famous openings of a poem in world literature. Beshnoi ne chonchekayat mikonad as jodai hekayat mikonad. Listen to the reed flute and the tale that it tells, how it sings of separation. And that's really Rumi. I mean, Rumi's always somewhat singing the blues. I mean, this idea of separation, Jodayi in Persian, which was also the name of the film that won the Academy Award 2 years ago, Separation, the Iranian film. So it's still in the culture in some way. That this separation is at the center of his poetry, and it becomes increasingly for him not just separation from friend, but the human condition of being separate from God. I mean, when you ask about how it was accepted, basically there become then Masnavis. There are Quranic reciters in the Islamic tradition who can recite the Quran. They're also then become Masnavi reciters who can recite Rumi's poetry. So during his life, I mean, in that world, it's, you know, it was very important. And then I think one reason that it remains, while so much else has been lost from that culture, is that you get a Mevlevi order after his death, and everything is kept and preserved. And then as the Mevlevi order spreads, the poems of Rumi spread also. So, you know, so in that way, an important revered figure. But he was also remains then a controversial figure. When he returns to Konya after he accepts the death of Shams of Tabriz, he takes off his kind of north silk robes and turban that the traditional scholar would wear, and puts on the simple blue woolen robe and a dark blue head wrapping. And that becomes his clothing until the end of his life. And it's a Sufi kind of way of dressing, like a monk, like a Franciscan monk. But also it was the color of mourning in Persian culture, this dark blue. So, you know, this very different figure who is in many ways beloved around Konya and going into the Armenian neighborhoods, different religious neighborhoods, preaching to packs of dogs, and so lovable in that way, but also gets in trouble. I mean, there are fatwas brought against Rumi in his lifetime for using musical instruments in religious practice. So there was this tension between a fundamentalist interpretation of Islam and a more mystical Sufi interpretation was present then, as it is still present at the moment. And also Shams of Tabriz had a fatwa brought against him for seeming to drink wine, wine also forbidden in Islam. So he was, you know, pushing the envelopes in ways which had caused Sufis to be executed in other times and other places. But through the happy accident, I guess, of being in this kind of outpost empire a little bit of the Seljuks, Seljuk Turks, and in, you know, in a way having this kind of charm. I mean, the same poems they were listening to that we're listening to now. And, you know, so there was something obviously special about Rumi, which, you know, allowed him a kind of protection during his lifetime.
After his death in 1273, did his reputation sustain itself, or did it? Or was there any sort of period at which it lapsed or lay fallow before it was picked up later on?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it definitely lasted in throughout the culture in many ways, and I mentioned that it was preserved in these Mevlevi lodges, but the Seljuk Empire, Konya, the Caliphate, which the ISIS talks about now, which is in Baghdad, was destroyed. The Caliphate earlier by the Mongols, who took the Caliph, who was both Pope and King, and put him in a sack and stampeded him with horses. So if you read the poems of other poets at the time, there was this real sense that it was the end of Islam, perhaps. And then the Seljuk Empire falls within a few years after Rumi's death. All that could easily have been completely lost. Rumi's paper is preserved by the Mevlevis, and then at a certain point, different Europeans come across this poetry, usually in Istanbul, and then the German romantic poets pick up on Rumi, like Goethe, then the American transcendentalists like Emerson pick up on Rumi, then the English orientalists do, and then now I mentioned the American New Age movement in the 1990s. So he keeps having this life that keeps reviving itself in some way. And remarkable in that way. So throughout throughout the world, Rumi the poetry of Rumi is beloved, and some places even more so than others. So very much so in India, in Iran, in Israel, in Europe and America, and maybe a little less so in Arab countries. But you know, at this point, as a kind of, and certainly a Turkey, beloved figure. So global in an enduring way.
It seems very appropriate considering that he lived in the context of his time, a very global life, very well traveled, and it speaks to, I think, sort of a cosmopolitanism.
There was a cosmopolitanism also at that time. You know, I mean, that the all these communities that you're reading about in Baghdad and Konya are all, you have Christians and Jews and Muslims living together. I mean, they were in different neighborhoods and there were tensions, but there was a lot of exposure to each other. So at Rumi's funeral in Konya is still remembered as being remarkable. And part of this was that besides the traditional Quranic reciters, Rumi had singers and dancers whirling and reciting his poetry. And also in the procession were Christian priests and Jewish rabbis who were reciting psalms. At a certain point, it was a big crowd scene, this funeral. At a certain point, some of Rumi's followers basically felt that their funeral was being taken away from them. And had it stopped, the governor had to intercede, the parvaneh, the Christian priests and the Jewish rabbis brought in, and the Christian priests said, well, you don't understand, you don't know how much time he was spending with us in the Armenian neighborhoods or at the monastery of Plato, Greek Orthodox monastery outside of town, you don't know what you have there. So there was all written, and then so they conceded, and the funeral went back and made its way by sundown to the Rose Garden, where Rumi is buried, and his shrine still has 5,000 visitors a day today in Konya. But even then, there was his inner faith message, while coming out of his religion, was remarkable enough to get that kind of reaction, and part of his endurance and importance today remains the way in which he's seen as an interfaith icon.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Right, when I'm resting, and I am doing, still doing translations of Rumi's poetry with Maryam Murtaz, and I tweet them on @RumiSecrets on Twitter. Turns out the lines of Rumi are perfect for tweets. I mean, if you'd been alive now, you could easily be doing, you'd do very well with the 140 characters. So that's what I'm doing, and then mulling over what to do next.
Oh. Well, I hope the project that you do next is going to be just as interesting, but hopefully not quite as demanding as Rumi's has been.
Yes, I have to think it through.
Well, Brad Gooch, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Okay, thanks very much.